Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Penny Nelson of KQED in San Francisco, and I'll be your moderator for today's program. Our guest is Margot Adler. She's a veteran NPR correspondent and can be heard regularly on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and Weekend Edition. She's based out of New York City and reports on the intersection of politics, culture, education, and art in all its many and varied forms. Her reporting has also included topics involving legal and constitutional issues, such as the death penalty, affirmative action, and the culture wars. Margot Adler has traveled the back roads of America and the world, reporting on both those in power and those who live on the margins of society. All that reporting has led Ms. Adler to reflect on some of the deeper and more soulful questions about our culture. And those reflections have in turn led her to write on some of our nation's more unusual spiritual interests, including the book Drawing Down the Moon, which is a study of contemporary nature religions, and her new book that we're talking about today, Vampires Are Us, Understanding Our Love Affair with the Immortal Dark Side. In it, Ms. Adler explores why we love vampires in movies and television shows, and how these terrifying, fantastical creatures have such traction in our culture, impacting power, politics, morality, and identity. And despite being born in Little Rock, Arkansas, and raised in New York City, the San Francisco Bay Area gets to lay claim to Margot Adler as well. She studied political science here in the Bay Area at UC Berkeley before heading on to Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. So with that, we want to give a warm welcome to Margot Adler.
It's a pleasure. It's great to be here and to be back in California, which I haven't been for, probably a decade almost.
Well, we welcome you. We're bringing you a little rain. We're bringing you a little rain. Or you brought us a little rain. Well, I want to start by, we'll talk a bit about journalism and your career in journalism, but let's start with the book. I must confess, vampires are a topic that I never really glommed onto in the way that we seem to have as a culture in the last decade or so. And it was interesting to me to read that it wasn't until just a few years back anything of great interest to you. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what it is about the vampire myth that took hold.
Well, at first it was really about mortality and immortality. I was never interested in vampires. I had probably read two or three books. I was a big science fiction reader, but vampires just didn't get there. I'd read maybe two Anne Rice novels. I knew Whitley Strieber, so I had basically read The Hunger. I'd seen that incredible movie with Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie and Susan Sarandon. And, that was it. That was really it. I had no interest in vampires whatsoever. And I was going to a conference in Florida, and I needed a trashy novel to read on the plane. And so, what the heck, I went and bought the first Twilight novel. And I read it, and I kind of got, it was a plane ride. It was kind of fun and kind of interesting. And I then, did this thing where I got the second one for the way back. And it probably would have ended there. I probably would not have even finished them. And eight days later, my husband, who was the healthiest man on the planet, I mean, he was a runner, he was... He wanted to live forever. He took all kinds of supplements. He never smoked. He never took any drugs in his 60s, unlike me. He was like Mr. Health Person, right? And suddenly no genetic history, and suddenly out of the blue, he gets diagnosed with a terminal form of stomach cancer, the kind you usually get in Asia. And death was a big thing for him because his parents had been killed in a plane crash when he was 16, and he was the oldest of four. So here he was, he suddenly gets this diagnosis, he lives only 9 months, and I'm like sitting by his side, and for whatever reason, I suddenly started obsessively reading vampire novels, one after another. And I think at the beginning, it was all about mortality, immortality, dealing with the whole question of death, which had been a big issue in our marriage anyway because of the experiences he had had. You know, there's that Woody Allen line, I don't want to achieve immortality through my works or from my books. I want to achieve immortality by not dying. And that was sort of basically my husband's attitude. And my attitude was much more kind of, I'm kind of a pagan and I believe that like a seed, we sprout and we grow and then fall comes and then we sort of seed ourselves through our next generation and that's perfectly fine. And what about the persistence of consciousness? Well, I don't really know, but I'd read this feminist book on the I Ching by Barbara Walker, the feminist author, and she had talked about how the real meaning of the elements, which I sort of said, well, maybe we just go back to the air elements. Maybe we just become earth, air, water, fire. That seemed fine. The real meaning was they were the ways you went to death. So you were either buried in the earth, or you were left as carrion for the air, or you were burned on the pyre, or you were sort of dropped into the sea. And I thought that was fine, But there was a little part of me that kind of went, maybe I really... maybe another 100 years would be kind of fine, despite this. So in the beginning, it was all about immortality. And I think that what happened was at some point in this exploration of immortality, I suddenly went, wait a minute, that's clearly not why most people are interested in vampires. Clearly something else is happening in the culture. Otherwise, Hollywood would not be spending, $7 billion in the last, 2 years on all these movies and all these television shows. Something else is going on. And all my friends said, oh, it's sex. It's all sex. It's all teens and sex. Just, that's all it is. And it didn't seem right to me. It didn't seem quite right. Yeah, there was a lot of sensuality in these vampire novels I was reading, but I wasn't reading a lot of the really bad romance novels with the formulaic sex and, six scenes in which they were going, he filled me, And I was like, oh my God, you want to throw them against the wall, But, I was reading the classics and there's no intercourse in Anne Rice, There's no intercourse in Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough and this Countess, Saint Germain. There's blood and ecstasy through biting and stuff, but it's all sensual. As a matter of fact, you could argue that it's a more feminist, more woman-centered way of dealing with sensuality. So I started thinking, well, okay, it's not sex. And then I had this weird thought. I thought, how we used to believe that rape was all about sex? And then we realized, no, it's all about power. I then started thinking about power.
But let's go back for a minute about the immortality thing, because
okay.
Because the power thing is a whole different part of this, which is so interesting. But the immortality, so you're sitting there at your husband's bedside and you're devouring for the first time ever vampire novels. So they've hit something on a core level in you, which is about, living forever, or what does it mean? Or you're a person who's of the earth, so I believe in cycles, and my husband is somebody who fought the death concept. When you say that he sort of wanted to live forever, had you guys ever discussed or thought about what that would mean? Because so much of what the vampire dilemma is being stuck and living forever. And what had your husband even thought about the concept of living forever?
Well, he was definitely a kind of astrofuturist, He basically, I think he believed that he wanted to live at least 200 years. Not forever, but 200 years. And he was taking all these supplements and stuff like that.
And for real, he thought that.
He really thought that there would be all these new breakthroughs, and he was reading up on all the breakthroughs and stuff like that. So he really thought, and I think if he thought what he wanted to do with his, body or ashes, he'd say, oh, I want them sent up into space. He was a real space freak. Well, so am I. And So I think he didn't really think about the tension that I started discovering in the vampire novels I was reading. And I suddenly realized, I went back to some of the old science fiction that I had read, like Olaf Stapleton wrote this book in 1930 called Last and First Men. It's an incredible sort of saga of human beings going through like 6 or 7 different species. And one of them lives at least a thousand years. And they become so bored. They become so bored with their lives, right? You know? And if you think about the tensions that come up even in a book like Tuck Everlasting, which all the kids read. And then I started thinking about Twilight and the fact that, Rosalie, the sister of Edward, was really upset with her situation. She wanted a baby. She wanted to be part of the life cycle. And being a vampire completely made this impossible. And I started realizing that there was this sense of frozenness that immortality promised. And so there really was a tension between not only my husband and I's views of death, but just within these vampire novels, they were really exploring that situation.
And staying with that idea of immortality and the lengthiness of potential life, when the vampire stories emerged a couple hundred years back, this was not even a plausible concept. So we're talking now about vampire stories written in the 21st century, vampire stories written in the 18th century. They represented really different storylines and different dilemmas at different times.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of the most groundbreaking sentences that I came across was in Nina Auerbach's book, Are Vampires Ourselves? And she says, every age embraces the vampire it needs. This was a huge revelation to me, and I started looking into what that meant. And I started with Dracula and Bram Stoker, and I realized in 1897, England had the largest ports in the world. There was an incredible fear of disease coming in. There was an incredible fear of immigration. And so, therefore, what Stoker does is he creates this unbelievable monster, this monster that basically brings dirt from a foreign land, basically is this image of all the things that represent the fears and concerns.
And quintessentially exotic.
Right, exactly. And so that was what I think was the meaning in 1897. And then in the 80s, for example, there were all these parasitic novels where right at the time of the AIDS crisis, And then you have this moment in 1816 when Paula Dore writes the first vampire story in the English language in the same chalet, in the same weekend that Mary Shelley writes Frankenstein. And, so what was going on there? Well, there was the fear of science replacing God. There was a lot of that stuff going on. And so I suddenly realized that there was a reason for almost every one of these periods. But then I started asking, okay, that's all great, but it still doesn't explain what's happening now. Exactly. So what's happening now? So there was this moment when I took all the sort of most popular TV vampires and a few in the books that I kind of had been dealing with. I had, been watching Buffy. I had never watched Buffy originally. I watched the entire Buffy, right? Every single episode.
And there is a lot to be said for Buffy.
Yes, we can talk
player.
About, yeah, the power issues and the feminist issues.
Power.
Very into, we'll get back to power. But first of all, the thing that was really amazing was that I put these vampires sort of on a line on a piece of paper. I'm just going, the Cullens, Stefan and Damon in the Vampire Diaries, Angel and Spike in Buffy, oh yeah, Bill Compton and Eric Northman in True Blood, oh, Mick St. John, oh my God, the wonderful vampire detective in the one season of Moonlight. So I put these all, the Tanya Huff, I put all these, vampires together in one line. And I say, okay, what do they have in common? And how do they differ from the vampires that went before? And it was like I had this light bulb go off in my head. They're all struggling to be moral and often failing. They are all desperately struggling to be moral despite being predators. And that's exactly who we are. It's just that our blood is oil. And we are sucking the lifeblood out of the planet. And I suddenly, like, you know, I just kept on having this sense that these were all these conflicted, struggling moral, you know, struggling to be moral vampires. And then I started thinking, well, when did that vampire start? And I first thought, oh, well, it clearly goes back to Anne Rice and, you know, Louis and all that. There's clearly all that conflict, moral conflict going on in Anne Rice. So it goes back to clearly the 70s. And then I started seeing it was like there was stuff before that. And I kept on going back. And then one day I went, oh, my God, it goes back at least to Barnabas and Dark Shadows. And so that's like 1967, 1968. And that's when I started thinking, and this was only at the very end after I'd been obsessing on vampire novels for 3.5 years and had read almost the entire 270 that I read, which is totally insane. That was the moment when I suddenly realized that it had to do with some stuff that began to happen around 1968.
Such as?
Okay. So in 1966, Stuart Brand, the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, was sitting on a rooftop in San Francisco, right here, stoned out of his tree on LSD. And he was trying to figure out, he was kind of having this moment when he was thinking about Buckminster Fuller, the futurist, geodesic domes, architect, all that stuff. And apparently Buckminster Fuller had said this quote that he was thinking about as he was stoned on LSD. And the quote was that the root of man's misbehavior is his notion that the earth is flat and infinite. And he came, and he was stoned, so he was looking off the rooftop, and he sort of felt he saw the curvature of the earth. Now, of course, he did not see the curvature of the earth, you know, normally from a rooftop in San Francisco, but being stoned, he saw it, right? And he came down from this LSD trip, and he decided to print up a political button. And he printed up the following button, 66. Why have we not seen a picture of the whole earth? Which didn't happen until 68. And he sent 200 or 300 of these buttons to all kinds of people. He sent them to NASA. He sent them to Soviet diplomats. He sent them to U.S. Congress people. He sent them all over the place. And, of course, in 1968, finally, we saw in Apollo 8, the first really clear color picture of the Earth rising. And then in Apollo 17, we finally saw this blue marble, incredible picture, which is probably the most reproduced photograph in the world. And that photograph, all the astronauts talked about how it changed them. And, you know, they could sit where they were in the Apollo program, and they could take their thumb and they could blot out the Earth. They could completely blot it out, and there it was gone. And they realized, I think people realized, even though the first experience was, oh, aren't we wonderful? There are no boundaries from up here. We're all brothers. I think that the secondary perception was, oh, my heavens, we are vulnerable. We are complicit. We are responsible. And we, you know, have to get it together in some way. And interestingly enough, Stuart Brand, who in the Whole Earth Catalog says, we are as gods and might as well get good at it. In his later environmental books, he says, we are as gods and have, in capital letters, have to get good at it. In other words, otherwise we're doomed. And Carl Sagan wrote about this. All kinds of people wrote about this. And I think that there was this perception that everything changed at that moment. The first Earth Day happened in 1970. You know, we began to have this understanding of the environmental stuff. And we also realized how bad we were about it. And how, you know, and I think that as that changed, our vampires changed.
Well, and the vulnerability, that's the key word, that the planet, as immense as it may feel to us here, it's this small little jewel. And when you factor in immortality, longevity, power, these three ideas, this little tiny sphere that's out in the universe seeing that image, and that we're really, you know, prey as much as predator. We're out there able to be handled, I guess.
Well, you know, and that's Whitley Strieber, when I talked to him, and he's an old friend, I said, Whitley, you know, am I crazy? What do you think about it? He's the author of The Hunger. He's the author of Communion. He's the author of a lot of different things. He wrote also the screenplay and the book for The Day After Tomorrow, that environmental film. He wrote Nature's End. He's written a lot of kind of crazy alien books, but he's also written a lot of environmental nature books and also some horror. He wrote Wolfen, The Hunger, etc. And I said, you know, am I crazy to think this? And he says, our prey is the planet. Mm. That's what he said to me on the phone, you know. And it was like, just, it really reverberated.
Mm. Okay, so now let's take that and the next step, because power, so immortality is one of these traits that the vampire holds that's both attractive and we kind of come to realize maybe a little bit frightening or repulsive, but also the power that these creatures, these mythical creatures have, that we, if the vampire is reflecting back who we are, and you are saying that the earth is the prey, the earth is the body that's having its juices sucked dry, and we're the vampire, the vampires are the mirror. The vampires
are the mirrors to ourselves. And there is a great quote about that. The reason that you can't see a vampire in the mirror is that the vampire is the mirror to our secret selves and to, you know. I want to talk about power. I really want to talk about power, because the other big insight that I had while I was doing this was that a lot of this was about power and abuse of power. And it started when I went, actually I was in California. So I guess I was here before a decade ago. It was in Stockton at the University of the Pacific. And there is a professor there named Amy Smith, who is a Quaker. And she teaches the literature of war. She teaches Jane Austen. But she also does an incredible course on vampires in film and fiction. And so I said to her, you know, you're a Quaker. This is kind of interesting that you're in this, you know, why did you get interested in vampires? And she said, every single good vampire film and novel asks the same question. Now that we're at the top of the food chain, do we treat humans as cattle? Or since we were once human, do we have to, in fact, respect human beings? And she said, you know, that's not a foreign question. That is a question that we all ask ourselves every day. What do I do if I have more power than someone, more status than someone, more money than someone? How do I treat them? You know, does might make right? So I started looking at this sort of issue of power. And the first thing I realized was that teens have probably the clearest view of abuse of power of anybody, because they see it every day. You know, they're under the thumb of their parents. They're under the thumb of school. And so they kind of have a sense of the abuse of power that's very, very clear. And the vampire often is this way of getting out of this, of kind of, you know, being strong, of being, you know, of being in a different world, of being, you know, they're the outsider. They don't understand what's going on, and they, you know, they get out of this situation.
And always lonely.
And always lonely. You know, I mean, even think of Bella in Twilight. I mean, she's like, you know, she's an only child, like I was. She's an only child. You know, her parents are divorced, like my parents were, so I got very into this. And she's, you know, and her parents are not very interesting. They're kind of boring, you know. And suddenly she has a choice of two very interesting families, big families, extended families. I would joke to people when feminists would say to me, oh, you know, Twilight is all about abstinence from a feminist point of view, and Edward's a stalker. I'd say, no, the Mormon element is really about large families. It's really, you know, we all want large families, and she gets two to choose from. One is working class and has all these fabulous attributes of, you know, the werewolves and the native lore and all that. And the other one is upper class and has Mozart coming out of the speakers and degrees on the wall. You know, much better than her middle-class family, you know. Either go up or go down, but I mean, you know, her family is boring, you know. And one of the things that I started thinking about is, actually I wanna talk a little bit about high school and how this affects teens, because one of the things I did while I was thinking about this issue of power, and I should say one thing about Buffy, which is that Buffy is all about power. And the last season of Buffy has had probably hundreds of scholarly articles about what happens there.
And for people who aren't super familiar with Buffy, give me just one little thumbnail.
Okay, so Buffy is this young kind of valley girl who basically suddenly becomes the chosen one to fight these vampires. And at first, and she's not, you know, she's not a good student, she's not a whatever, but she becomes kick-ass in many ways, and she does this, and lots of stuff happens in it, and she becomes this, you know, the big, powerful thing. Well, in the last season of Buffy, suddenly her authority is questioned. And it's questioned by many young women who basically want to become slayers like her. And she is forced to renounce patriarchal power. She is forced to renounce it, to basically say that all these women are as powerful as she is and that she is not the authority. And it's fascinating. And there are literally hundreds of articles about this. So as I was thinking about all these power issues, I wrote Anne Rice. I really wanted to know what she thought. I wanted to know why, okay, the central question that I was coming up with was, why do vampires have such traction right now in our culture right now, which no one was answering. So I wrote Anne Rice a letter, and I said, "Dear Anne Rice, you know, could you tell me what you think of why there's so much traction with vampires in our culture?" And, you know, and she started her email to me very kind of, "Well, I don't really have anything insightful to say, and it's not very much, and the vampire's the outsider, and all of this, blah, 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 blah." And then suddenly, at the end, she says, "But for teens, the vampire represents..." What is it? I may have to actually get this quote. "Represents a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them." It is a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. And I started thinking about high school. I started thinking of corporate culture and jock culture and bullying and the pressures of parents and the pressures of school. And then I started looking again at Twilight and at the fact that the Cullens had to do high school like 5 times. You know? Can you imagine going to your senior prom 5 times? I mean, as I joke to a lot of people, that's the true horror story. I mean, that's really, I mean, that seems like more of a horror story than anything else.
Well, on this same idea of the power and the slayer and all of that, there's a great question here. It says, "Since all cultures, pre-literate and worldwide, have some mythology about a creature that cannot die, why do you think there are so few vampire stories from people of color writers?" And this plays, I think, perfectly into the whole conversation about power, who has power, who doesn't. And what do you think about that?
Well, I actually... in the 270 vampire novels that I read, there are actually a whole bunch written by African-American writers. Mm. There are a whole bunch, some of which are really interesting. I mean, one of the most interesting is Octavia Butler, who a really brilliant science fiction writer, unfortunately now dead, who wrote Fledgling, a really interesting, and it's all very much about, it's both about race and all kinds of issues about that, but it's also about a lot of issues of free will and determinism and relationship. It's a brilliant novel. There's a guy named Terrence Taylor who's written 2 fabulous, fabulous novels that basically deal with, oh, some of them take place in the Harlem Renaissance and all kinds of other stuff. There's a woman named Alea Johnson, another African-American writer, who has, you know, has written 2 novels on this. So I'm not actually sure that that's true about vampires and African Americans.
And perhaps it's just that there's a handful that we all know so well.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's true. Just like there are when you start reading all these novels, you know, at first you think it's only men that are vampires, right? And then you finally get into all the women that are vampires, and there are a lot of novels with women that are vampires that are very, very interesting. So I'm not so sure, but there was another part of that question that was interesting that I wanted to riff on. I forget.
Well, that all cultures, so referring to pre-literate and worldwide, have mythologies about creatures that cannot die.
I don't know. Maybe we can go on.
All right. I just want to do a quick re-ID here. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking with NPR reporter Margot Adler, the author of the new book, Vampires Are Us, Understanding Our Love Affair with the Immortal Dark Side. I'm your moderator, Penny Nelson. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online on our YouTube channel. And again, there's questions on your question cards on your chairs if you have ones that you want to submit. Another question that's come in, what needs do vampires fulfill in our current culture?
Oh, well, I'll tell you an interesting thing. One of the most fascinating books I read while I was doing research, because I also was reading a lot of nonfiction books about vampires, was something by Martin Ricardo called Liquid Dreams of Vampires. And in it, he analyzed the fantasies of hundreds of men and women who had fantasies about vampires. And what was most striking, and I can totally identify with this, is that almost all of them didn't want to meet a vampire. They didn't want to make love to a vampire. They wanted to be a vampire. Basically, you know, they wanted that kind of strength. They wanted that kind of, in some cases it was immortality. In some cases it was a fear of dying. In some cases it was that kind of strength. There's, what's her name? The biographer of Anne Rice has a book in which she describes her youth. And she says that when she was a kid, she had dreams about Dracula, and she would go to bed, and she would put her arms like this, and she would dream that she would, you know, she would say, maybe I'll wake up as a vampire. And she would tell people that she was 403 years old and stuff like that. So I think that part of it is simply wanting to be in that place where you have more options, essentially. And when you, you know, I mean, it's feeling an outsider. It's feeling that you don't really belong in this culture, which is definitely a feeling of probably 95% of high school students at this point, and probably a lot of us still at some level. And I confess that I've had my own vampire fantasies.
But the characterization, I mean, and you mentioned even, which I think is so perfect and timely, you know, what is the term that the Occupy Wall Street folks use? Bloodsuckers,
right.
Vampires, Wall Street, this idea
this goes back.
This is part of the power thing that I think is the, you know, is such a part of the question, which is, what do you, talk about moral ambivalence, what do you do when the only way you can be self-sustaining is has a negative ramification for somebody else? You must suck someone else's life in order to sustain your own. And that's, you know, in a vampire story, okay, that's very literal, but societally, how do you survive in our culture by exclusive of harming someone else? It's a hard question.
Yeah, and interestingly, in some of the novels, they figure out a way that you can do it without harming others, and in some of them, they don't. In the classic ones, they didn't. You know, people died all the time. Some of the modern ones, they figure out ways to do that. But I'm always fascinated by the fact that the notion of vampire in a political sense goes back actually to something like 1688. There was it's also in Voltaire's Philosophical Dictionary. He has a section on vampires in which he basically says that, the vampires that exist do not suck blood, but they live in very fine houses and are, you know, clearly the riflers of the public, so to speak. And Marx talked a lot about vampires. Engels talked a lot about vampires. Occupy Wall Street, of course, used vampires in their demonstrations all the time. So, yeah, and during the financial crisis, during 2008, there were a lot of articles about how like the Glass-Steagall Act was like, you know, the ray of sunlight that would, you know, make a vampire run screaming and stuff like that. There were a whole bunch of articles like that in 08 and 09 during the sort of financial crisis.
But that seems to be so at the core of, you know, here's this whole being survival depends on essentially harming others. And talk about the, you know, when you say that the current motif for vampires is one of moral ambivalence or moral questioning or struggling, trying to be moral. That's how I feel like the young, talk about the teenagers also. They're raised in a culture where all they're seeing is that the way one makes it, the way one survives, is by
making
by
money.
Hook or by crook.
Making money.
You have to stomp where you have to stomp because you've got to make it your own way. And it's a, you know, it's a metaphor.
Right, yeah. Speaking as someone with a 23-year-old, I mean, you know, to try to stamp some values about that, you know, and not think that, you know, that you have to be rich and whatever, you know, is like, you know.
Here's a couple more questions. Here's one that says, now that you've read 200, oh, how could you do this to her? Now that you've read 270 vampire novels, which would you recommend?
Ah. Well, cool. In my book, I will say, Vampires Are Us, I do have a section of the best, and I basically say you're clearly not going to read 270 vampire novels, so I will give you like a dozen that I, you know, from different genres. And we should talk a little bit about this whole notion of genre for a second, which is before I give you a list of some.
Especially that, because you started by saying you picked up a trashy book for your airplane reading.
Yes, exactly. And you know, here we live in a culture where romance novels are like 20% of everything published, and yet, you know, none of them would get, you know, reviewed in the New York Times. There's this basic sense that, you know, genre novels are less valuable. And sometimes they are if they're, you know, hideously written. But there's a wonderful essay by Ursula K. Le Guin, who's one of my favorite authors of all time, particularly The Dispossessed and Left Hand of Darkness. But she has a lot of essays about speculative fiction and fantasy. And one of the things she says that I love is she says, publishers call my books science fiction, but left to myself, I would call them novels. And she has this fabulous essay called Why Are People Afraid of Dragons? And she kind of talks about how fantasy is, many people are afraid of fantasy and because they're afraid of freedom. And she's, you know, and so one of the things that happened to me when I was reading all these novels was I started realizing that there were genres within genres and that, you know, it wasn't like there, well, first of all, when I said I'd read 270 vampire novels, people would say, there are 270 vampire novels? And I'd say, well, in a book that was written in 2009 with a list of all vampire short stories and stuff like that, there were 5,000, and that was 6 years ago. And so I was looking at this and suddenly realizing that there were detective novels. There were presidential vampire thrillers. There were
talk about that one. Just
talk
for
about
one
that
second.
One for a minute. Okay. So one of the best books that I read, definitely on my best list, was something called Pursuit of Darkness by a guy named Jeff Gillenkirk. Jeff Gillenkirk had been a speechwriter for Mario Cuomo, and so he had a real sense of Washington, a really great sense of Washington. And so he's got this novel about a kind of a Washington Post reporter who's kind of down on his luck and alcoholic and sober and then gets off the wagon and on the wagon and finally gets demoted and finally is given a chance to redeem himself by interviewing this huge political operative, clearly a Karl Rove character, clearly. And this guy tells him that he's a 200-year-old vampire. And so he's trying to figure out if there's enough proof for this. And they're like, never is. And the whole novel is how he's trying to do that and how he never can do it. And it's very, very interesting. So they're presidential vampire thrillers. There are nerdy, geeky. Oh, I have a section, nerdy, geeky, nerdy, geeky adult, young adult novel. So, for example, there's a book called Suck It Up by Brian Meehl, that basically is about a 15-year-old kid that gets turned into a vampire and has to live with acne for the rest of his life, right? Right? There, that was not on my best, but on my best were two by a woman named Kimberly Pauly called Sucks to Be Me and Still Sucks to Be Me. And basically, they're fabulously funny novels. They're novels about, you know, a young girl who discovers her parents are vampires, but, you know, and she has to make a decision when she's 18, and both choices are hideous. And finally, she makes the decision and has to leave with all her friends, and but she has to go, and she's still under her parents' thumb, and her life is still yucky, and, you know, but it's very, very funny. Another great novel is Fever Dream by George R.R. Martin of Game of Thrones. And it takes place in the 19th century on a Mississippi riverboat and is really interesting and unusual. In the romance category, and there were so many bad romances, I will say, that I really hated most of them. But my favorite was The Circle Trilogy by Nora Roberts. And I had never read a Nora Roberts novel, and I just kept on thinking to myself, Nora Roberts, she's, you know, she's written 250 novels. She must have a stable of writers. It turned out not true. She writes 8 hours a day for 30 years. That's how she gets 250 novels or whatever. And this Circle Trilogy is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It's beautifully written. It's incredibly powerful, and I had to eat my words.
Mm. Yeah. All right, let me ask you to project a little bit forward, and we will move a little bit over to your journalistic career. But before I do that, I'm curious, in as much as a person can, if the vampire of every era reflects who we are and what we're ambivalent about or concerned about or our anxieties, can you take us down the road a little bit? Do you think
if we solve climate warming, we'll not have that many vampires?
We'll have more apocalyptic zombie stories.
Yes, right. Well, that's more. I think that's more about apathy, you know, or just.
I keep thinking that's about the pandemic. That is about our fear of a pandemic and
Partly about, but it's also about a kind of apathetic kind of creature that's kind of.
No, Margot, they're fighting the zombies.
Okay. But if you were the zombie.
If you were the zombie.
Then you'd be an apathetic creature, right? You'd be really apathetic.
Well, I will say that vampires are us. As I started out by saying, it was a topic I had not really ever thought much about and hadn't been a big fan of the whole field, TV or books. And boy, it was a new look at what they represent about the bigger story for us. Now I want to shift a little bit while we still have some time and talk about your amazing journalistic career, which I know was started right sort of in the heat and the times of new media at that time, new public radio. Talk a little bit about how you got started, and then I'm really eager to hear from you. We're in another transition phase with media now. You've been a reporter and on the radio for some 35 years. Talk about the beginnings and also where you see media going.
Oh. Well, okay, I started, just like with vampires, it all happened by fluke. I was a student at the University of California in Berkeley, and it was my senior year, and I had 3 failed weeks on the Daily Californian, which they wanted me to write headlines, which I just was really bad at. And I took that famous test that you take, you know, where you basically, I forget what it's called, but basically you answer 300 questions and they pair you with people in the field and they say what careers would be best for you. And everything I had rejected came up on top. So, you know, I came from the psychiatric family, psychiatrist, psychologist, they were like the top two along with, I had been at the High School of Music and Art and voice, you know, musician, whatever. Everything I had basically not done while I was in college was like up there, right? I was depressed. You know, I went into the counselor. She said, well, maybe social work. I was completely depressed. The next morning or the morning after, I turned on the radio, and it was KPFA in Berkeley. And the news director, Don Porcher, was reading George Orwell's Politics in the English Language. And after he read this incredible essay, he basically talked about their philosophy of news and how, and it was very simple. It was, we call things by their real names. We don't say the red Chinese. We say the Chinese. We don't say the Viet Cong. We say the National Liberation Front. We don't, you know. And at the end, he asked for volunteers, and with my heart in my throat, I went, and I basically called him up, and I started volunteering there. And after about 6 months, I graduated, took this little tape of me reading the news, you know, and I went to, had some junky job, you know, coding surveys for an NYU professor in New York, and then finally got the courage to walk into WBAI with my little tape. And I went and talked to the program director, very famous guy, had been to Vietnam, Dale Miner, very interesting guy. And he played footsie with me under the table and said, "Women don't do news. Their voices are too high." 68, radical Pacifica. That was the attitude. But since I was willing, since I had a regular job from 9 to 5, finally 2 weeks later, he said, "If you're willing to work for nothing, why don't you come in and do our 11 o'clock newscast?" So I did. And 3 months later, they had a marathon, and I got $85 a week from then on. And then, you know, all kinds of things happened. And the way I came to public radio, to NPR, was completely fluke also. I basically I loved WBAI. I loved what I did. I did talk shows. I did all kinds of stuff. I was there at Washington Bureau for a year. I did it was fabulous. And the community at Pacifica was so much more intense. All I can tell you is, the way I would describe it is this. You could be on the radio, on NPR, and you could do a story that you worked your absolute butt off for 3 weeks, and the only letter you receive is, you pronounced Beijing wrong. You could be on, you know, WBAI, and I was talking very personally. I talked all about my life. It was a very personal show. And you'd get 10 single-space letters. And just there was a level of community involvement that was incredibly powerful. But then all kinds of, you know, as we know, Pacifica is messed up in many, many ways. And one of those messes ups happened, and we ended up seizing the station and occupying the building, and they cut the cords, and we were all suspended, and all kinds of stuff happened. And then a year later, I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. I was writing Drawing Down the Moon. And a year later, someone called me up from WBAI and said, "We're having one of our fundraising marathons. Will you come down and pitch, you know?" And I said, "You know, I hate you guys. I'm so angry at you, but you're the only game in town politically. Yes, I'll calm down. What the heck?" And next to me was somebody, the other person pitching, was somebody who I had worked with at WBAI in 1972. This was now 78. His name was Neil Conan. Mm-hmm. And after we had our little pitching shift, he took me out for a beer. And he said, I said, "What are you doing these days?" He said, "I'm producing a show called All Things Considered." I had never heard it. I mean, NPR was like state radio to me, you know. I was like, you know, I mean, I, you know, I wasn't listening to NPR, you know. And
yet it was new at the time.
It was 8 years old or 7 years old.
But still finding its way.
It was still finding its way, exactly. And he said, "Would you like to freelance?" And that's how I got to NPR. If I hadn't gone down to that, if I hadn't fundraised for WBAI that day, it probably never would have happened.
So stay back in time a little bit, because what I think is interesting is right now the new media, the new formats that we're still not completely comfortable with or convinced are valid, blogging or citizen journalism, all these different things that are being thrown around, you know, the validity of those new formats is really being challenged, questioned, bandied about. Well, likely when you were at Pacifica, that was, I'm sure they were saying, that's not journalism, that's storytelling. That's not journalism, that's long-form blather. That's, you know, so as somebody who was there at the kind of the generation, the birth of one form of new, slightly revolutionary in that it wasn't Murrow, it was new. What do you think when you see the new formats emerging and challenged and called blathering or uncurated or, you know?
Well, some of it I love. I have to admit that some of it I think is amazing. Like, I think that I think that the citizen reviews on Amazon, for example, I get much more information from them than I do from the New York Times book review. I'm going to be honest about it. If I want to know what's going on in a book, you know, because the problem is that the New York Times reviewers, they review every day. They are jaundiced. It's like the play reviewers. They're very jaundiced. They have basically, you know, they're looking at it in a certain literary way. I'm not reading that many books. You know, I want a book that's great, you know. And so when I go on Amazon and see 40 reviews and I look at the fours or whatever, and, you know, I get a much better sense. So some of the new forms I think are really, really work. I think social media, some of the social media stuff, the Facebook stuff, the Twitter stuff, I think some of that is great and some of that is, you know, I have to say that I put all my pieces on Facebook and Twitter. And I find that that's useful because a lot of people aren't, you know, a lot of people that I know are not listening necessarily to the radio. And so it's useful for me to do that. I mean, some of the blogging is, yeah, some of it's uncurated. Some of it's, you know, I don't have as much of a problem with that because I, you know, coming from a place originally that was kind of crazy and radical and everything like that, I'm willing to sort of say, let's just see what happens for a while. Let's see if this, you know, it's gonna probably find its way. It's gonna get better.
Where do you go for your news?
Where do I go for my news? Well, I have to admit I do listen to NPR a lot. I mean, I get up in the morning and I get up very early. I get up at like 5:30 and I put on Morning Edition so I hear the whole show. I don't listen to the rest. I listen to On the Media, which is very much about new media and digital technology and the NSA and Snowden and all that kind of stuff. I love On the Media. I think it's very much about both new and old media in a really interesting way. I still get a paper version of the New York Times just to basically, I don't know, I like the paper version of the New York Times, so I don't read that much of it, but I, you know, I like, I don't know, I like handling it. I like books. I like paper. I like all of that. So I.
Where should people who want their long form storytelling be looking now?
Oh boy. You know, it's what's sad is it's not even at Pacifica. You know? It's not. One of the things that really struck me is that the Pacifica stations have become much more kind of ideological, I feel. Whereas the stuff we did in the 70s was crazy, but it was personal. I mean, I would go on the air and do, okay, I would do things like this. Hi, I'm 29 years old, and I don't know if I ever want to have a kid. I'm an only child, and I'm afraid I would break it. And what's more, I think that if I had a child, I would become a Stepford wife because I'm a really good rebel while I'm alone. But if I had a kid, oh, my God, I would be like the biggest conformist in the world. So I'm totally petrified of having a child. So I would do that. I would go on the air, and then I would just open the phones. Well, you can imagine what the personal response was of something like that. And I don't hear much of that anywhere.
But what I would say is the big criticism right now about a lot of new media is that it's too personal, too confessional, too self-absorbed, too narcissistic, too young, and yet it sounds like the very thing that was being offered up then, which was community and local and small and personal.
It was personal, but you made it larger.
Larger.
You know, after you told your personal story, then you made it into a larger question. Mm-hmm. You said, well, how does this relate to the community? And suddenly you would get incredible things. And then you would get these 10-page single-space letters, you know, of people saying they'd made a great decision or they'd made a wrong decision or having kids was great or whatever. So that's just one example. But I had this woman on who talked about her essay called The Asexual Manifesto. Never forgotten this, you know. And she, it was probably in like 1970, whatever. And all kinds of people, you know, it was like the idea that anybody would say they were asexual at that time,
right.
You know, it was like completely crazy, right, you know.
And the so ultimate that, rebel.
Ultimate rebel, you know. And so she, you know, you were able to do things. And I don't see, I mean, you were talking about some places where some of that was happening. But I don't see a lot of it. So
I think there's a lot, there's a lot of online outlets that are, and that's what's, I'm so curious as somebody who's, you know, you've got such a
super solid career and kind of a, been bookending it. And a lot of the online outlets, and one thing that Margo and I were talking about earlier was a program like 99% Invisible, which is this online program where, I mean, there's stories being told, but it's that thing that's got to happen that happened with public radio where it's got to shake out, where it gets, you know, the talent gets sophisticated enough and polished enough that it's good, but there's always going to be that awkward period of time where somebody's doing their personal confessionals on the radio, and then it, you know,
but then, you know, down. Some of that, some of the raggedness was great. You know, I mean, I was telling Penny that, you know, when I look back at my pieces from the 80s, some of them were like 18 minutes long and 12 minutes long for NPR, you know, 15 minutes long, 20. Now, if you get 4.5, you're really lucky. You know, most of the time you're getting 3.5, you know. So the pieces are much more polished now. They're very, you know, you're editing out every every this, every that. You know, it was much more ragged, but there were many more deep ideas, I feel, in those old days. And maybe, do you feel that some of the stuff is having those ideas?
I feel like there is an amazing amount of great stuff out there. It's almost like there's so much. The problem is curating at this point. There's so much great work being done, so much young energy, so much enthusiasm for innovative storytelling. And the trick is going to be, how is it going to shake out? Who's going to get airtime? Who's going to get noticed? But a lot of ragged journalism is going on, which is great. Well, let's bring this all the way kind of full cycle. We're winding down time-wise. And, you know, you've got your career as a journalist, clearly, and your writing work. What are you looking at next? Vampires are now, you're putting them to the casket.
I'm actually reading normal books occasionally, you know, like, although there are certain ones I'm going to continue, certain series that I really like.
Did you lose some friends with your endless vampire novel reflection?
No, I didn't. I didn't, because I've never been a kind of elite reader, you know. I've never a book club member. I was never so I never had to deal with any of that. So I don't think I didn't lose any friends. I mean, there were some people who thought I was a little crazy, but.
Well, one of the question cards that came in that I didn't ask was about this, you know, we're also in a superhero fanaticism phase. Vampires are a little bit the anti-hero. And the question asker was mentioning the idea that we also love our superheroes right now. We seem to be grabbing and clinging and needing some forces that are bigger than ourselves. I guess we always have.
Yeah, and I think, and that was the most surprising thing. At the very end of my sort of four-year obsession was I started realizing that there was a spiritual dimension to all of this, which I had never thought about, which was completely weird considering that I've been involved in chronicling the pagan movement for, you know, since 79. You would think that maybe I would, you know, have thought there was a spiritual dimension here. And I came across this book that was just wonderful called Gothica by a woman named Victoria Nelson. And she's a professor at Goddard College. And the thing that was fascinating about her was that she started talking about sort of the idea of... She has this one chapter on Twilight in which she talks about how it's really about... It's not about any of the things we were talking about before. It's not about large families. It's not about, you know, abstinence. It's not about anything. But if you think about the Mormon, getting back to Stephanie Meyer as a Mormon, there's that notion that when you die in Mormonism, you know, if you're really, really good, you'll get your own planet. You'll kind of become a god.
Oh, that I did not know.
You did not know?
No.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's there. You can, if you want it, you can see the Book of Mormon. It's in there. It's really funny. It's great. But anyway, Bella becomes a goddess. That's clearly what happens in Twilight. She becomes the queen of the chessboard. She's as powerful as Edward.
Know the Mormon connection but me? I did not.
You did not know that Stephanie Meyer was Mormon?
I didn't know the Mormon
thing.
Oh,
yeah, everybody. Yeah, there's been a lot of essays about Twilight and Mormonism and stuff like that. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But anyway, so Bella becomes this goddess and, you know, it's pretty amazing, you know, to think about that. And one of the things that she says is that Victoria Nelson says is that there's this that there's this turn of the sort of horrific and the horrible and the gothic and all that, that there's a turn toward the light right now, that a lot of these creatures that were considered so sort of terrible and awful and something are suddenly being sort of rethought of in a much more positive way.
You mean culture-wide?
That culture-wide. That we're adopting them in a much more positive way. And there's been some of that all the time. I mean, there's a science fiction writer named Fred Saberhagen that has written a kind of positive Dracula series, including one where Dracula works with Sherlock Holmes and all kinds of wild things.
And have you noticed that as somebody who's involved in the pagan community? Have you noticed that with Wicca, with witches, with any of that?
Well, the pagan community has pretty much been positive, you know, generally. I mean, there's some negative stuff, but they've been pretty positive. But this really, it kind of blew me away because I hadn't taken the next step to say, oh, is there a religious dimension to all of this? I hadn't really thought about that. And of course, Victoria Nelson also gave me my favorite quote in all of this, which is, of course, that I end the essay part of the book, in which I say, it's a quote that she uses, she sort of drops away, and she sort of attributes it to the spirit of Philip K. Dick, but it's really not a Philip K. Dick quote. And she says, you know, when the divine has been exiled from elite art and culture for over a century, sometimes you have to find it in the trash. And so when anybody asks me, how could you, a reasonably intellectual person, how could you spend 3.5-4 years reading vampire novels? I say, here's a quote. This will answer it for you.
I was looking for God in the trash.
I was looking for God in the trash, and I found God in the trash.
Well, I think that gives us a lovely wrap-up point. So thank you very much, Margot Adler. Well, we've reached the point in the program where I think we want to say thank you so much, Margot Adler. We want to say thank you for joining us here in the Bay Area, bringing the East Coast rain to us and relieving us a little bit of our drought conditions. And thank you for sharing your wisdom and your 5 years of research that you pulled together in 4 years of research in Vampires Are Us, Understanding Our Love Affair with the Immortal Dark Side. And also, thanks so much to you for coming out today and for our listeners on the radio for being with us as well. I'm Penny Nelson, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.